This is the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group, supporting Jewish communities worldwide. I'm Michael Daventry, and coming up on this programme... We all know that online hate is nothing new, with people from all walks of life subjected to abuse, insults, and worse, often from people they've never actually met. But why aren't social media companies doing more to deal with the problem? And should we be forcing them to? Anyone who is on social media these days, and if you're listening to this, the chances are you are on social media, knows that it's not particularly difficult to find someone who simply wants to be nasty. If you're Jewish and on social media, that nastiness can turn into hate very quickly.
So you'll get various neo-Nazis who will make references to putting Jews in the ovens and or gassing Jews or you know, mentions of Zyklon B as the gas used.
That's the voice of Daniel Sugarman, Public Affairs Officer at the Board of Deputies. He spoke to the Jewish News podcast this week in a personal capacity.
You get a lot of Holocaust denial or Holocaust revisionism, which is also a big problem on a lot of these platforms. You'll get references to the shape of Jewish noses, supposedly. That one comes up fairly regularly. Jewish monetary control of the world, you know, the Rothschilds running everything. The organization I work for has apparently, on the far left, supplanted the Rothschilds as being the shadowy force controlling the Labour Party, for instance. We see so many references to the Board of Deputies' supposed control of the Labour Party, which is absolutely insane. But at the same time, it's very clear that these people genuinely believe that, and it's quite scary.
Daniel has a sizable following on Twitter, so he attracts more hateful traffic than a lot of us. But his experience will be familiar to anyone who is identifiably Jewish on social media. That could mean someone wearing a kippah in their profile photo, or sporting a Star of David necklace, or even just a mildly Jewish-sounding name. And the hate does not just come from the far right.
Well, it's interesting because obviously there is a large amount of far-left anti-Semitism online as well. But the one thing that we saw very clearly during the Corbyn years was that there was crossover. And you would get, you know, statements and pictures that had been very common from the far right that were making their way onto far left forums and into, you know, far left conversation. And whenever people try to call it out, they were, you know, viciously attacked online by the far left. You know, how dare you say that we're doing this? You know, don't you see this is all about Israel or whatever it was? I would say that the far-right anti-Semitism online tends to be much more in your face. I don't know, only the most tone-deaf individual could possibly argue that that's not anti-Semitism. Far-left anti-Semitism will often be couched in sort of words that can provide wiggle room, potentially. So, you know, the evil Zionists are doing this, that and the other. Often these people will take great pains to say that, you know, we don't hate Jews. Jews are wonderful. It's just, you know, Zionism and you know, Zionists aren't true Jews, etc., etc., which is itself, you know, in my opinion, a form of anti-Semitism. And you'll see a lot more of, you know, this attempt to sort of justify the bigotry, whereas the far right are, you know, have no problem, you know, admitting that they're bigots. But yeah, that's an interesting kind of contrast.
So there's no doubt that anti-Jewish content makes a sizable proportion of the hateful material that seems to be regurgitated across social media these days. We've known this has been a problem for years, but what to do about it? More and more people are saying today that social media companies should be better at policing their own content, and if they fail, governments should punish them. We'll talk more about that in a moment. But back to Daniel. His approach is to confront the hate himself. He calls out social media users when they share anti-Semitic content or make questionable remarks. He compiles screenshots and shares them with his followers. It's a name and shame technique. He says it's worthwhile.
I think it's a good thing because it shows people often unambiguously the problem. It's very easy for people to deny that a problem is happening unless you literally thrust the evidence in their face. And so in that regard, I think it's helpful. I know that people, particularly during the Corbyn years, contacted me and said, look, I genuinely didn't realise that this was an issue and I dismissed it, and I thank you for what you've done, because, you know, it's really brought it home to me that this is a real issue. And that obviously was always very good to hear, that it was making a difference in that regard. I can't say for certain how much of a difference it makes in general, but I do think it's important to keep doing it, because it is all too easy to deny evidence. You know, you look at some groups who will deny evidence even when it's kind of presented to them, but how much more so when you just are making a claim and don't necessarily back it up. So if you've got the kind of screenshots to show that exactly what you're talking about is happening, I think that's extremely useful.
But there's only so much that individual users can do. There's so much hateful content out there, and what's worse, it can be duplicated, triplicated, multiplied many times over with the click of a button. It can feel like beating back against the tide. Jonathan Greenblatt is the chief executive of the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, which monitors acts of hate both online and offline in the United States. He says the problem has become endemic.
You know, ADL is the oldest anti-hate organization in the world. And we've been, you know, talking about the fact that social media is a veritable super spreader of extremism and hate. And in particular, services like Facebook really are the front line in fighting anti-Semitism and other forms of bigotry today. And look, it is nothing short of breathtaking to consider the sheer scale and size of these businesses. Facebook alone has literally about 3 billion users, right? That's some 40 odd percent of the planet's population. And that's been achieved in less than two decades. Their revenues last year topped $80 billion. And their net income was somewhere in the ballpark of $24 billion. So these are some of the most, I mean, literally, it is one of the largest companies in terms of its kind of consumers, users in the world. It's one of the most profitable companies on the planet. And it arguably has the most significant, like, sophisticated, you know, targeting capabilities of any advertising tool in the history of capitalism. So it really has no peer. And these systems and services, all of them are really without any true comparison in history, because it's not just a way to take in information, Michael, right? It's how we now socialize. It's how we shop. It's how we search. I mean, it has habituated the human race in really extraordinary ways.
So social media has become an indispensable part in our lives, and it's happened quickly. In less than two decades, companies like Facebook have come to offer us an essential service, just like our local council or school does. But unlike those latter two, social media has grown with limited oversight from the authorities. At the moment, there is no Ofsted for Facebook. Jonathan Greenblatt again.
It's complicated to build businesses of such sophistication, of such significance. You know what's not complicated, Michael? Knocking Nazis off your platform. And so I think this is not, if you will, a bug in the system. I think it's a flaw in the business model that these firms were able to flourish in an environment without any regulation, without any kind of oversight, in part because the ethos of a company like Facebook was like, you know, go fast and break things. That was literally the unofficial motto. Another motto that we learned from the recent book, An Ugly Truth, was company over country, was another phrase that was frequently used inside the halls of Facebook. And so the libertarian ethos inside these businesses, the fact that they're working on a field of technology that was certainly not well understood by elected officials or policymakers, the fact that certain laws literally exempted them from not just the kind of moral responsibility, that's they have something they have to face up into the mirror, but legal kind of responsibility, and the kind of different classes of stocks relieved them or exempted them from the kind of fiduciary responsibility. Take all that together, Michael, and I really believe that the business model itself, which emphasizes, you know, algorithms really over ideas and prioritizes free expression, right, over user safety, creates the conditions in which this disease has flourished. Now, like any disease, it can be cured. Like any disease, it can be treated even before it's cured. But the companies are going to have to roll up their sleeves and do some serious work if we're ever going to put this genie back in the bottle.
This is a hot topic, not just in the United States, but around the world, particularly after leaked documents from a whistleblower called Francis Haugen showed Facebook knew about the harms its products cause and often did little or nothing to mitigate them. Here in Britain, the government is preparing a new law called the Online Safety Bill. It's been 2 years in the making, and one of its central tenets would be that platforms like Facebook would have a new duty of care for their users. That means they would be legally required to take action against content on their platform that is illegal. They would also be required to act against content that is legal, but harmful. And remember me saying there's no Ofsted for Facebook yet? The Online Safety Bill will create that, giving the responsibility for overseeing social media companies to Ofcom, which already monitors Britain's TV and radio stations. So is the British law up to scratch? Will it help Jewish users of social media feel that little bit safer? Or at least feel that if they complain about something they've seen, their complaint will be taken seriously? Imran Ahmed is the chief executive of the Center for Countering Digital Hate, which campaigns to try persuade big tech firms that they shouldn't provide services to people who spread hate and misinformation. He says he's impressed with the new law that Britain is putting together.
Well, let's start with two observations. The first observation is that this bill is only possible because Britain is independent and is able to legislate and regulate for itself. And I think the confidence with which it's brought forward legislation that is certainly the most advanced we're seeing in the world right now is really impressive. The second thing is that this bill is now being perceived by lots and lots of people that have concerns about the way the internet works as the solution to their particular problem or their particular bugbear, and it's never going to be able to satisfy everyone. What it does do very well is that it offers a regime for transparency and it offers a regime for accountability.
Because the problem right now is that social media companies, Facebook especially, are deeply secretive, and nowhere more so than with the cogs that make the entire platform turn, the programming code known as algorithms.
You can't hold someone accountable if you can't see exactly what they're doing, because as we find at CCDH, when we put out a report saying, you know, we found the Facebook algorithm doing this, Facebook say, but you can't possibly know that because we don't tell anyone how our algorithm works and we didn't tell you because you're not our friend. And it's, you know, all right, okay, fine. All right, well, then show us your algorithm. It's time. It is about time now that we actually got to see how these companies work. So there's a transparency regime in there. We think it should be more intrusive. Look, there should be a more intrusive no-knock inspection regime for companies like Facebook than there are for your average, you know, sandwich shop.
What he means is that government regulators should have the ability to ask questions, and social media companies like Facebook should be compelled to answer.
It creates a lot of harm for other people, so the costs are being borne by others. And all the health and safety regime, the accountability mechanisms say are, if you don't reduce those costs, we're going to fine you for it. So if you don't reduce the costs that you're imposing on society, we'll fine you for it. And you know what? If it's particularly egregious, we may well jail you for it. Now, the government has kind of balked criminal charges bit of it in that it won't actually allow for executives to be individually told you may be held individually responsible and therefore be given a custodial sentence if you serially fail to protect human life and safety on your platform despite being told again and again and again by the regulator. And the government's pushed that decision-making out and said Ofcom can take the decision as to whether or not it wants to have the powers to bring criminal charges. I think most of Parliament, certainly when I was there giving evidence to the Online Safety Bill Committee a few weeks ago, most of Parliament feels it's time for us to have those criminal powers today.
Criminal powers meaning giving a regulator like Ofcom the power to prosecute. It's not an unusual practice in Britain for organisations other than the police and the Crown Prosecution Service to file charges in specific areas. The Environment Agency, for example, can do it against industries that are polluting the environment. But there's a catch. The proposals aren't necessarily about giving a sense of justice to individual users or about creating a sort of court system for the online world.
Well, it's not going to create a means of restitution for the individual. So the individual's not going to be able to say, I want to have action taken against that person. But that's not necessarily a bad thing, because what it will allow for is for Ofcom to take decisions to whether or not, for example, anti-Semitism is spreading unfettered on the platform. If it is, then to impose costs for the spread of anti-Semitism unfettered. It will allow for representations to be made to Ofcom for how to perceive anti-Semitism. So it will allow for a discourse on it. Now, you know, my personal view, and I'm a slightly chippy northerner myself from Manchester, so, you know, I think, oh, those Westminster people, I don't know if they'll actually get it. But it will create a mechanism for it, and it's not one that we've had before. We at CCDH have had the frustration of having people write to us and say, I've had X problem, what can I do about it? And the answer is nothing. That's the answer. We can now say there is a mechanism, with the potential of credible action at the end of it, with the potential of your case being part of the reason that real change happens, that fines are imposed, that someone ends up going to jail. And I think that that's a really powerful thing for us to be doing.
One key question is how to perceive anti-Semitism. When someone writes a slogan or posts a picture online, what is it that makes it offensive, indeed insulting to Jews? How do you define it? Broadly speaking, the Jewish community already has an answer to that. A definition of anti-Semitism from an intergovernmental body called the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, or IHRA. That definition has been adopted by governments, agencies, and private companies around the world. But social media companies are reluctant. Let's go back to Daniel Sugarman.
In my current role at the Board of Deputies, we've approached all of the major social media companies and asked them to adopt the IHRA, International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, definition of anti-Semitism. We've received the same sort of responses, which are all like, well, our current community guidelines are inspired by aspects of the IHRA definition. And in some cases, I've produced documents showing in detail exactly how the community guidelines fall short. We recently got the Secretary of State for Digital Culture, Media and Sport to write to the major social media companies strongly recommending that they adopt the IHRA definition. None of them have done so. We reached the point a while ago where we realised that the only way that social media companies were going to do this is if they were compelled to by the government.
So the argument is that social media is polluting our online environment. And there's a reason why we're focusing so much on Facebook in particular. Jonathan Greenblatt again.
Keep in mind that Facebook and Google between them control 80% of the online advertising market. But again, I think the sheer size and scale of Facebook and the nature of the service, it's different than Google, which is at its core, although they're a set of productivity tools, it's a search engine. That's what it is. And it's an operating system that runs on mobile devices. Facebook has become this all-encompassing platform, and for so much of the world, it's almost like the operating system, how they navigate the internet, in a way that likens to the old dial-up services of, you know, two decades ago. So Facebook is the internet in much of the developing world. Facebook is the interface through which they navigate online spaces. And so for that reason, it has a disproportionate impact on the user experience, which is unlike, again, a Wikipedia or a Google, which are certainly very ubiquitous services as well, but are used for much more discrete purposes. I think secondarily, you know, ABL, look, we're the oldest online hate organization in the world, as I said before, and we're a data-driven organization that's been doing this kind of work since we've been doing attitudinal studies since the 60s. We've been doing auditing, you know, hate incidents since the 70s. We've been looking at kind of global attitudes for more than a decade, and we in recent years have started to conduct annual surveys of online hate and harassment. And that's germane here because our own data shows us that, irrespective of size, just on a per capita basis, if you do statistical analysis and based on our surveys of users, we find that the platform where hate happens most frequently, where harassment is reported most regularly, is far and away Facebook versus the other services. More so than Twitter, more so than Reddit, more so than YouTube, more so than, you know, even like Instagram, which is another Facebook product. It is Facebook itself. And you can rebrand the service. You can call it Meta. You can call it Muda. You can call it whatever you want. The reality is that this is the place where users, at a rate of almost three times any other service, report being serially harassed and violated. And that in and of itself tells us, when we see this year over year over year, that there is not just a persistent problem, but something that's core to the user experience that needs to be addressed once and for all.
Clearly, the question of online hate is not an exclusively Jewish concern. Hate comes in many forms and affects minorities and vulnerable people everywhere. But Jonathan says there's a reason why the Jewish community in particular should be so worried.
The Jewish people, for thousands of years, lived in diaspora and lived in diaspora always with a persistent degree of peril, marginalized, you know, socially or physically, knowing that there was always an inquisition or a pogrom or kind of an expulsion right around the corner. And then with the advent of the Enlightenment on your side of the pond several hundred years ago, and the Age of Reason that followed from it, and the kind of the widespread dispersion of liberal democracy in places like the UK or in places like the United States, we have lived in diaspora with tremendous privilege, with the kind of protections we hadn't had throughout our history. And I'm not going to include, you know, the state of Israel in this kind of conversation. I'm talking about living in diaspora. What I think we know to be true is that literally the form of governance, the type of society which has been consistently delivered the best results for the Jewish people has been liberal democracy, where our fate wasn't the subject of fiat of the king or the, you know, the fickleness of a pope or whatnot. It was indeed like liberal democracies that had the kind of rule of law and protections in place where minorities' rights were preserved. There's almost two millennia of history that shows us how things go for our community when we don't have, again, liberal democracy, when we don't have, again, pluralistic systems, when we don't have, again, rule of law. And if you try to understand what's the through line in the weakening of our kind of social structures in recent years, what's the common denominator in the degradation of our, again, public conversation and the accelerant that's pouring, you know, that's kind of like expediting these flames of populism? So you come back again and again and again to social media and the filter bubbles that it's generated and the algorithmic amplification of our like worst impulses. And all of that, Michael, I think makes solving the problem of social media, addressing these ills once and for all, a profoundly Jewish concern. And all of us need to be committed to do this in a manner which, again, respects debate, which ensures dialogue, which doesn't tamp out voices, but which once and for all draw some lines in order to protect ourselves and our children in these societies that we have that we've built up over so long. They're much more delicate than you realize.
We contacted the main social media companies to ask them about the themes that have come up in this podcast. Twitter sent us a lengthy statement saying the company is working to make the platform a safer place for online engagement. It added, "Improving the speed and scale of our rule enforcement is a top priority for us. We recognize that there's more to do and will continue to listen and integrate stakeholders' feedback in these ongoing efforts." TikTok told us that it uses a combination of artificial intelligence and human moderation teams to remove Holocaust denial and hate speech directed towards Jews. It said that between April and June 2021, TikTok identified and removed 93% of videos that violated its policies and did so within 24 hours of them being posted. Facebook, which was recently renamed Meta and also owns Instagram, did not respond to our request for comment. We asked all the companies if they planned to incorporate the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance's definition of anti-Semitism in their guidelines. None of them responded. That's it from the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group. Through its partners, GPG is working to support the growth of Jewish community life in the UK and worldwide. To find out more, visit www.gpg.org. All that's left for me to do is to thank my guests, Daniel Sugarman, Jonathan Greenblatt and Imran Ahmed, Leo Mendel and Adam Bradley for their work in post-production, and to you for listening. Please do subscribe to the show in your podcast app. That way you'll hear any previous episode and be informed when new episodes become available. And don't forget that for more information on any of the stories that we've featured, you can always go to jewishnews.co.uk. And if you'd like to comment, then we'd love to hear from you on editorial@thejngroup.com. That's editorial@thejngroup.com. From me, Michael Daventry, do join us next time here on the Jewish News Podcast. Goodbye.